Yeah, there's been a lot of research on the genetic basis of homosexuality. Almost all research has indicated that even with the genetic predisposition, there has to be environmental triggers, meaning to say, without the environmental trigger, a person can certainly go to the heterosexual way. And in fact, most people, their sexual identity is a transitional, meaning it can move in either direction, depending on. Each of us are potentially homosexual or heterosexual, and pivotal environmental experiences in early adolescence can push you in one direction or the other. Based on that, there is possibilities of change. And again, as I say, it's not great, but when there is religious motivation, the possibilities are stronger. So that's option number one. Again, I'm just listing options, knowing that all of them do raise problems. Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, is it a true change, or are they just repressing, like, who they are, or like who they want to be? Like, I just wonder, like, even how, like, okay, so then just say those guys, like, they go through that sort of therapy or treatment,
yes,
and they feel better, and then they get married. Like, how is their marriage at that point? Like, I don't.
So this depends. I have heard. Listen. I am aware. Again, I'm aware of a lot of different stories. I am aware of people who were gay, religious, and they just decided to get married because they wanted to follow the Torah. They didn't even tell their wives that they were gay. Now, that's a tragedy waiting to happen. Obviously, a person who marries a woman not revealing that their attraction is to the same sex is committing a fraud. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein Paskin, the woman doesn't even need a get when she finds out. She can walk away without even a divorce because that was a marriage under false pretenses, and it's a tremendously destructive thing. But if somebody did have proper therapy, that doesn't mean, like anything else, that doesn't mean they've totally overcome their desires, but it means that they're able to adjust in a livable modality, and that's okay too, meaning the half loaf might be better than the whole loaf. Meaning to say that if they're able to have a loving relationship, if they're able to have a sexual intimacy, if they're able to raise children, if they're able to function at a moderate level of happiness and productivity, the fact that there's something yanking at them from that past, Voltaire used to say that the best is the enemy of the better, meaning to say just because something cannot be 100%, doesn't mean you try not to make it as good as it can be. And I think on net, this could be positive. Now, alternative number two, which may be very draconian, is we tell a person the following. And again, I'm not saying this in the spirit of cruelty, because it really is very heart-wrenching. And that is, people are born with many, many trials in life. There are people that are born, babies that are born with AIDS. There are people that are born without arms, without limbs. It is indeed a tremendous tragedy for which we don't really have the full understanding. Why a person might be born or environmentally triggered with a same-sex attraction, SSA, they often abbreviate it. But just because you're born with a certain attraction or you have a certain attraction doesn't mean you're allowed to act upon it. I think all of us understand this in the case of pedophilia. Right? There are people who are sexually attracted only to young children. Right? That attracts them in a very powerful way. And this is a very, very powerful sexual impulse. What is our answer to a pedophilia person? Well, sorry. You know, it's tough. We know it's tough. And you have to try to get treatment for this. But you cannot act. Now, the only reason why society treats homosexuality different is because between consenting adults, let them do what they want. Well, that's fine, but that's not what the Torah says. The Torah considers even homosexual sex between consenting adults as a sin. So one response might be to the homosexual, a very sad response, that perhaps your mission in life, like a Catholic priest, although that hasn't worked so well for the Catholics, as a Catholic priest, your job in life is to be celibate, and you will find love in friendships. You will find love in camaraderie. You will find love in service to the community. Although some people consider that also problematical about putting a gay person in a classroom. But basically, there is a concept that sometimes you have to sacrifice a certain dimension of your life and find joy and fulfillment in what you're able to do in your life There can be, as you know, anyone that's single who has friends knows, there can be deep joy and deep love in friendship. And friendship is not the same as marriage, and friendship is not the same as the one-to-one intimacy of love. But there can be a love just the same. And therefore, option number two is, if the orientation cannot be changed, the person still has to be given the instruction of not acting upon it. And that is hard. I don't mean to be callous in that way, because there are many, many things that I do that are sinful. And to tell a person, just say no, on something as basic as this, is very, very difficult. But at least as the mission statement, that would be the Torah's mission statement. Now, point number three, no person is defined exclusively by their sexual orientation. Even if a person is a homosexual, a person's doing a sin. Well, that's bad. I gotta help him not to do that. But they're still a Jew, they're still a human being. Just as in a typical synagogue, there are people who don't keep Shabbat and people who don't keep kosher. They're not living up to the Torah, but they're still Jews. We still welcome them, we still care about them, we still have them over our Shabbat tables. So in a sense, just because somebody's a homosexual, it doesn't mean he's walking around with a big H, you know, on their chest. This is part of their life of which we do not approve. But that doesn't have to taint or stigmatize them in the other parts of their lives. A person is more than their homosexuality, just as a person is more than their heterosexuality. A heterosexual is not defined by their sexual relations. A homosexual doesn't have to be defined by their sexual relations. So psychologically, it's a very important point to say that even if a person is doing one thing that's wrong, this is true in all Judaism, that doesn't taint their ability to do other things that are right. This is true about everything. Even if you're not keeping the Shabbat, you can still make Kiddush and still light candles. Even if, you know, you're not keeping kosher, but at home, you know, you can keep kosher. Or every Tuesday night, I'm only going to have vegetarian. One should never say, one's attitude should never be, if I can't do the whole thing, I don't do anything. Every little bit counts. And that's a message to a homosexual as well. A person happens to be doing something that is against the Torah, that's fine. But that doesn't mean you can't do so many things that are according to the Torah. So, if people ask me, would I welcome a homosexual couple? I've been in Israel 5 years now, but I was a synagogue rabbi for 25 years. So I was a rabbi of a shul for many, many years. And in fact, I had neighbors. Baruch Hashem, I didn't have to confront the actual customers. They didn't apply for membership. But I had neighbors that, you know, we had a casual relationship. We happened to be two women. And the two women, in fact, they adopted a boy and they had a bris milah for the boy. But the question would be, if they would apply for membership in my synagogue, would I allow them to be members? And my answer is, yes, they could be members, provided they don't publicly celebrate their homosexual union. We would not allow a kiddush for that. We would not allow a celebration of a gay marriage. But if they keep their sexual relationship to themselves, then it's frankly none of my business. It's between them and God. And they can be welcomed like every other Jew. It gets a little complicated when this couple would have a circumcision, like, do we come and we celebrate with them? Well, that's a little complicated. Do you look at the circumcision as a separate thing? Or do you look at it like a celebration of the family unit? You know, things are tricky. This world is very, very tricky. But that's kind of the basic approach. All right, so far we discussed different perspectives. One is changing orientation. One is the lesson of abstinence. The other is, even if a person is not going to abstain, they can still be accepted for the good that they do. And that's very important to know, that God treasures the mitzvot that a person does, even if they're doing things that are not so great. But the same thing applies to an intermarriage. Somebody's married to a non-Jew. No good. But they can still have Shabbat, they can still have davening, they can still do mitzvot. This is one of the things that has always impressed me about Chabad. I am not technically, I think I'm the only non-Chabad teacher at my Yanot.
No, not that.
Is there another one? Oh, I used to be the only one, I'm sorry. Oh, I lost my distinction. But okay. But one of the things that I've admired a lot about Chabad is that idea of accepting people where they are, and that is a very, very important principle. You don't have to be perfect. It's better to be okay than to be not okay, meaning to say, you don't do 100%? I mean, I don't do 100%. Nobody does that, right? Don't know that? Okay. But doing 10% is better than doing 5%. Doing 11% is better than that. So whatever you do counts, and whatever you do is worthwhile, and therefore the attitude towards a fellow Jew, and really a fellow human being, is not to say, you're a bad, evil person, get out of here, but to kind of endorse the good that a person does, even if you don't agree with some of the bad things that a person is doing. Okay, so these are the perspectives that we have, but they are very difficult. Now let me mention, in the Hasidic community, kind of an amazing thing that they came up with. Now you might think this is perverse or bizarre, but, well, let me throw it out to you and see what you think about this. In every community, you're going to have male gays and you're going to have lesbians. So their idea was, let's make a shidduch, let's match in marriage the male homosexual and the female lesbian, and get them married. Now you might say, well, what sense does that make exactly? Well, it makes sense in the following way. To take a male gay and match him with a heterosexual woman is not fair, because she's not going to be, you know, there's not going to be the marital intimacy that would make her satisfied. But if you take a gay man and a gay woman, so neither of them are expecting sex as part of their marriage, so they create a relationship, they create a family, they're like roommates, they create the notion of a family unit. They can either adopt children or maybe even attempt an in vitro fertilization pregnancy that way. And what it gives them is, it gives them the appearance of a family, particularly in Hasidic communities, just having, you know, a family is kind of a way of being accepted. They become accepted into the community. They're kind of semi-legitimated. They acquire respectability. They acquire legitimacy. And although it is true that obviously they're missing a very important element of life, and that is sexual intimacy, but they can have friendship. They can have love. They do have connection. It goes back to the idea that they have, you know, I don't know what percentage is, but you know, 60% or 65% or 70% of what a family is, they can actually have. And although they're missing certain dimensions, they have much more than they would have otherwise. So I don't have the statistics here, but I understand that this has been done in a number of Hasidic communities. They take the lesbians and the gays, and they marry them together. And I don't mean just that they pick people at random, but they meet, you know, they're friends, and they understand the nature of the unusual marriage that they're trying to create. But it goes back to the idea that, you know, sexual intimacy is an important part of a marriage. I'm not going to deny that. But it's not the only part of a marriage, and it may not even be the most important part of a marriage. Love and support and caring and sharing life can be just as important. And it might be possible in that type of unusual pairing to have all of those things, even though they don't have the sexual expression in and of itself. Yeah.
I feel like in like communities that are that particularly prone, that there would be a shame associated with admitting that you're gay. And I just don't understand. I get like how on paper that would seem like a good match, but yep. I don't even see how they would come to be. Like, I can't imagine someone's like rolling up to their shadchan and be like, "Hello, I'm gay."
No, no, you're 100% correct, and I think I was a little vague. I didn't mean to say that this is openly done this way, meaning to say that when it's understood that there are people that handle it discreetly behind the scenes, and vis-a-vis the general public, although they might suspect, you know, you never know, but that's not the public persona. Now again, I understand this is difficult because, number one, people are living with hypocrisy and they're not really showing their true selves, and that is painful to some degree. But of course, that's a problem in Hasidic communities generally, where there are people who, you know, don't want to be Hasidim and they have a certain pressure. So, you know, I want to be honest with you. I don't want to lie to you that none of these solutions are a perfect solution of everybody will be happy, you know, everyone lives happily ever after. There are going to be difficulties here. And these are difficult trials. And why does God give a person this type of trial is a very, very hard question. But, as I say, just as would be hard, why is a baby born with AIDS? That's also a very difficult question to answer. And the wisdom of God is not always clear to us. We live in a world of concealment and a world of mystery. But all I'm saying is, you can't solve a problem by simply denying that it's a problem. If the Torah and the Noahide laws prohibit something, the fact that it's hard, the fact that it's difficult, does not give us permission to simply say, okay, let's just make believe it's okay. It doesn't become okay because it's hard to keep it. So it is very important that a person have compassion, a person not just be cruel and insensitive to people. But the one thing you can't do is to simply say, okay, this law is hard on people, so let's write it out of the Torah because it's hard. So these are kind of some reflections, and I do admit, not far, very, very far from perfect, on how to deal with this particular problem. Now, just a little comment on female homosexuality, because I didn't. Yeah.
Do they still fulfill the obligation of like prurient?
Well,
yeah. Retro.
Okay. Okay. So that's an excellent question. Well, that's a very good question. An in vitro fertilization with the male's sperm, as opposed to a donor sperm, would be pruriva. That's correct.
Use both.
Yeah, but if you use, if I'm married to somebody and we use donor sperm, and we'll talk about those problems, then I don't fulfill pruriva because it's not biologically my child.
Right. Okay.
But if it's an in vitro fertilization, a procedure from the male husband's sperm, that would be the valid fulfillment of the mitzvah procreation.
But it could be the male husband's sperm and another egg, and
that's
like
correct.
She doesn't have that's
correct. Keep in mind. Again, a little background for people who may not be totally familiar. It sounds like Baruch Hashem, you're familiar with this. The very first mitzvah of the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. That's the very first mitzvah of the Torah, to have children. But paradoxically, this sounds very bizarre, the mitzvah to have children is a mitzvah on the man and not on the woman.
That was Rosh Chodesh, was the first mitzvah.
Rashi says that, but that's a kash on Rashi. Rosh Chodesh is in Shemos, Perek Yud Beis.
Okay.
Pruervu is in Bereishis, all the way at the beginning.
Gotcha.
So what Rashi means is, Rosh Chodesh was the first mitzvah that was specifically given to the Jewish people.
Gotcha.
Be fruitful and multiply was a mitzvah given to the human race. Okay, but it is the first mitzvah, is that. Now, paradoxically, the Gemara says a statement that might sound a little bizarre, and that is, the mitzvah of pruervu is only a mitzvah on a man and not on a woman. Now, obviously, a man can't do it alone, but it basically means a woman does not have an obligation to have children, but a man must find a woman who's willing to have children, but the mitzvah is on the man. Which actually means, if a woman wanted to be single, she would have that. It's not encouraged. It's very, very far from encouraged. But halakhically, she might have that right. If a man wants to be single, he does not have that right. In the time, the Shulchan Aruch says, we don't do this today, the Shulchan Aruch says, any man that's 22 and didn't get married, we beat him until he chooses a wife. Meaning to say, we force him, get married, and the like. Now, again, halacha, we don't do that today. But that's the idea. So in terms of your question, as long as the child is conceived from the man's sperm, whether it's his wife's egg or another egg, he would fulfill, be fruitful, and multiply. She doesn't have that mitzvah. By the way, as a little aside, what would the logic be that a woman is not obligated to have children? Why is that so? So I'm going to give you two reasons. One reason is that very often the Torah gives you commandments when your natural inclination would be against it. So since a woman has generally a stronger maternal instinct coupled with a biological clock in which her fertility years are more limited, she would more naturally want to have children. And therefore, you don't need a mitzvah to say, thou shalt have children. A man might take his time. A man wants to sow his wild oats. A man wants to fool around a lot. So the Torah tells the man, settle down and be a father. So it might be that old idea. It's a very well-known idea for many things. that the people that get the commandments are the people who need the commandment or they wouldn't do it. That's one idea. The second idea works the other way, very interesting. Pregnancy and childbirth are potentially life-threatening conditions. To this very day, even today in the 21st century, even in developed countries, there is a percentage of women that die in childbirth. It's not safe. It's dangerous. I don't want to scare anybody. It's dangerous to have a baby. That's why if a woman goes into labor on Shabbos, we pick up the phone or we drive our car or we call a cab. It is called life-threatening. And we violate the Shabbat or Yom Kippur. So the Torah is not going to command a woman, put your life in danger. But the Torah will tell a man, find a woman who likes to take risks. Meaning to say, you have to find a woman who wants to do this, but we don't make the woman do it per se. Right? That's kind of the logic of why women don't have the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply. And of course it is very, very true that women do have, well, I mean, I'm generalizing, but by and large, women do have a much stronger desire to have children than men might. That is why infertility, which is painful for everybody, infertility, but it tends to be a stronger pain for women. You see this in the Torah itself, that when our mothers, our imos, didn't have children, the great pain that they suffered. Okay, any questions or comments? Okay, so this is what they do in the Hasidic, in some segments of the Hasidic world. Again, you can think about this, but you can see it is a big issue that we grapple with, and part of the problem, once again, is, as I say, the more society makes something normal and acceptable, the less motivation people have to take the steps they could take to change things for the better. So in a sense, we're kind of digging our own grave by making this all legitimate. Okay, but now just a few words on the female homosexuality. Female homosexuality is not as halachically severe as male homosexuality. Now that's very, very true. Lesbianism is not entirely, it is not explicitly prohibited. There are some sources that indicate it is not a proper practice, but as I say, it's not necessarily a Torah violation, and it absolutely is not a death penalty violation. Nevertheless, it is frowned upon simply because Judaism very much encourages men and women to get married. And anything that detracts from that goal, whether it's lesbianism, homosexuality, pornography, you know, anything that takes a person away from forming a man-woman relationship is not considered to be proper. But nevertheless, I do have to admit, it is not as severe in halacha as male homosexuality. Okay, so that was just a few perspectives on this issue that one should be aware of. Okay. I'm going to go on to actually a related topic, but a different topic. If anyone has any questions on this, I'd be happy to discuss it. Yeah.
Where does our own ethics come into play? Like, if some of us believe that.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be the issue that every Jew has to confront, and that is, normally conscience is a very important guide to life. God put a conscience in us, and that is an ethical sense of right and wrong. And we do pay attention to that. The only thing is that a religious Jew who connects to the Torah basically says that although my values are important, but when my values conflict with what the Torah says, I have to surrender my values to the values of the Torah. Now that's going to be a very difficult decision that every person in this room is going to have to make. That's going to kind of, you know, where you want to go with this. But I can speak, but again, speaking as a Torah-believing Jew, I have to say that although my ethical sense is very important, but I am obligated to surrender my personal ethics when the Torah directs me to do so. So the short answer is, you can't read things out of the Torah because they offend our ethical sensibilities. And they know that is a difficult issue. You know, when the Reform movement legitimated gay marriage a while ago, they basically took the attitude that if the Torah says things that are not consistent with modern notions of morality, we can amend the Torah just like you can amend the Constitution, right? Constitution can be amended. Well, once again, if you believe the Torah is a divine document, that's impossible. So we just can't do it. So I understand the pain of a homosexual, but there's nothing I can do in that particular regard. Okay. All right. So now, since we were talking a little bit about reproduction, let me go back and deal with it in a bit more arichut, a bit more length. The first mitzvah of the Torah is this mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply, mitzvah to have kids. How many kids do you have to have? Right? You have to have like 100 kids, 30 kids. No. So the mitzvah you fulfill with two kids, but they have to be one boy and one girl.
Wait, seriously? So you can... Okay,
continue. No, which means to say that if you have 10 boys, you got to keep going till you get one girl, or vice versa.
Seriously.
You don't fulfill the mitzvah till you have one girl and one boy. Now, the question is, well, what does that mean? Does that mean once I have one girl and one boy, we can do contraception? We can do birth control? Well, not necessarily, because although the obligation is one son and one boy, one son and one daughter, but the halacha is that one generally does not practice contraception unless there is a need, meaning to say the following. This is a very delicate area. If there are health considerations, if there's unusual stress, I don't mean life-threatening is not that's obvious, but I'm talking about if having children is very, very stressful, if there are health issues, if there's an inability to take care of existing children, then halacha does acknowledge the possibility of contraception. And if you talk to a rabbi, you will always see that it is much easier to permit contraception after the son and the daughter than it is before the son and the daughter, because before the son and the daughter there is the obligation of pru or vu. After the son and the daughter there's still an obligation, but it's less powerful. So I'm not here to give you a detailed guide. A contraception is one of those things that it's not the same as abortion. Abortion is much stricter, right? Contraception is not abortion. But contraception is one of those things that I would just say are discouraged, but halacha recognizes scenarios when it can become necessary, either for limited times, ideally, 6 months, a year, or even for a longer time, but it is not something to be done without consultation with a halachic advisor. It could be a man or a woman who knows all of this, because the mitzvah of having children is very great, and Kabbalistically and spiritually, it is said, Mashiach cannot come till all the souls in heaven are born. And it is said that when you prevent a soul from being born, you are delaying the coming of the Mashiach. So it's a very, very serious decision. It is not a trivial decision. And there's a wonderful quote from Goethe, of all people. You know, that's G-O-E-T-H-E, you know, the German writer, novelist, and philosopher. He was not talking about Judaism, but he had a wonderful quote. He said that when a person feels overwhelmed and they want God to give them the strength to meet their challenges, it doesn't work that, you know, give me the strength and I'll meet the challenge. It's the other way around. You got to take the first step. You got to meet the challenge, and when you meet the challenge, God opens up doors. So often, you know, I taught in a law school for many years when I was a rabbi. I was also a law professor. And I had many, many law students, young women, who got married in law school, and they brought their young babies to class. Sometimes they would cry. Sometimes they were older. They would do coloring. And it's very, very difficult, you know, to juggle a career. But if you make the decision, God opens up avenues. It's an amazing thing. You sometimes think, oh, it's impossible for me to have a child. How am I going to do it? But when you make the step to do that, Hashem will open up opportunities that weren't present till you made the commitment. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happens if either, because not every man and woman are capable of having children, so what happens if either a woman or a man can't?
Okay, so the answer once again is 100% correct. God never holds a person responsible for what they're not able to do. So essentially, they don't have the mitzvah, but God does not hold them guilty of it. Now, there is an opinion that says that if a couple adopts a child, they actually fulfill the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply through adoption. That's one opinion. There is another opinion in the Gemara that says, if you teach a child Torah, it is as if you gave birth to him. So that would mean either if I teach a child or if I finance their Jewish education. That's kind of my child. So there are spiritual ways of having many children. But certainly, you know, the technical mitzvah of Pru Urvu, if you can't do it, obviously you cannot do it. Yeah.
So I feel like there's a contemporary secular scientific opinion that women are supposed to wait a certain amount of time between the birth of their children for their bodies to recover.
Yes.
What is the Jewish view on that?
Okay, so there are different halachic views. There is one halachic view that says no contraception at all, and you got to start having a child as soon as you can. There is another view that says you can space children up to 2 years apart. So, and that actually fits within the contemporary view, permitting spacing both to allow recovery of the woman's health and to allow taking care of the child in infancy without the competition of another child. So there are different views. There are lenient views and strict views. You know the story of the woman, the Yerushalayim woman, who was climbing up a bus with her 10 children. And it was a very hot day, and everybody was sweating, and she said, "Ay, ay, 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 I am so exhausted with this group." So the bus driver said, "Why didn't you leave some of them at home? Half of them at home?" She said, "I did." You know. So the thing is this, you know, you look at a family of so many children, and people say, "Well, why weren't you on birth control?" So you could say, well, which of these children should I have given up? You know, it's a strange thing. As hard as it is, once you have the child, again, I'm not talking about the rare cases of abusive parents. Those are different things. But the normal overworked parents. Every child is a blessing. Every child is special. Not only that, but people with large families will actually tell you, in some ways, it's easier to raise a large family than a small family. When you have only one child, you go crazy. You don't know what to do. Once you have more children, the older children, at some point, take care of the younger children. And you actually have assistance. Observe the families. You know, you're gonna have the opportunity to see large families here. And observe how the families work together as a unit in many, many ways. And I've heard from mothers. I've heard from mothers of large families that it was easier for them to have, you know, many children than it would have been to have just one or two children, because now they have helpers and assistants and people that even play. Even if all they do is play with each other, they keep each other company. That's right, and that's a tremendous thing. Yeah.
So for the 2 year thing, would they like use contraception in those 2 years?
So according to that, they'd be allowed to use contraception for those 2 years. Now, that's a whole other issue. What type of contraception is permitted? Because male contraception, like condoms, are prohibited because that's treated like masturbation, because the seed does not enter the woman's body. So the best contraceptive is an oral female contraceptive, but that has certain side effects. Number one, if the woman is a nursing mother, the hormones could interfere with nursing. Number two, birth control pills have a minor side effect that in the secular world is so minuscule that it's meaningless. But for an Orthodox person, it wreaks absolute havoc. And that is, birth control pills, because of the hormonal secretions, create a certain amount of minor inter-period spotting. Which is nothing. Nothing at all. A little drop of blood here and there, big deal. But for halachic marriage, that is a nightmare, because it may create permanent nida status. You know, when a woman has a menstruation, even a drop of blood, you know, all of these prohibitions kick in. So one has to, if you do have a justification for contraception, you do have to discuss with your doctor very carefully the side effects of different medications to be sure that you would, you know, it wouldn't unduly interfere with marital intimacy and nursing and the like. But yeah, there would be some method of contraception that would be allowed. Now, in the time of the Gemara, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So the man has mitzvah per removed.
That's correct.
Does that mean that he's not allowed to marry a woman who he knows can't have children?
Yep, that's exactly right.
And does that mean that he has to divorce a woman
okay.
and find out afterwards?
Okay, so you were reading my mind quite literally. Initially, yeah. Initially, it is absolutely the case that a man who has not yet had two children is not allowed to marry a woman that he knows is unable to have children. That is absolutely the case, because he is obligated in pru urvu. The question we have, though, is, let's say a man marries a woman, and, you know, he doesn't know, and you can assume they can have children, and then it's discovered that she cannot, and perhaps she has a hysterectomy, or perhaps she just cannot. So the Gemara says, initially, there's a Mishnah that says, if a man marries a woman, and they have been married for 10 years, and there are no children, he is obligated to divorce her. Now that's what it says, unless they move to Israel, because once they move to Israel, the clock gets started over again, because the merit of Israel might give them a bracha. But if it's 10 years in Israel, you got to get divorced. Now, in the olden days, let me just say one second. In the olden days, divorce didn't have to happen because you could just marry another wife. Polygamy used to be permitted. But since polygamy is no longer permitted, divorce is the only halachic option. However, the Rama, who is in the Shulchan Aruch, says that today we do not follow this halacha because we recognize that the unique relationship of husband and wife is very important even when it does not have children. See, this is a very important idea. Having children is a great mitzvah, and it's a very, very important religious duty. But it is not the only meaning of marriage. Marriage is not important only because it produces children. Marriage and intimacy are vehicles of holiness and love, even when they don't produce a child. Now that doesn't mean you deliberately frustrate by birth control unless there's a reason for that. That doesn't mean abortion. But it means if circumstances were such that you're unable to have children, there is still a sanctity and a holiness in the marriage that should not be terminated. So the bottom line would be that a man should not marry a woman that he knows cannot have children unless he already has a son and a daughter. But we would not encourage divorce if, in the course of time, we find out that they're not able to have children.
So I'm just thinking of like a man who's older.
Yeah, this is a very excellent. You know, this is a very, very excellent question, and it's a real question. And this highlights the dilemma of halacha meeting a reality check. Imagine this happens. Imagine you have a guy that's 55 years old or 60 years old, never been married. Never been married, never met the right woman. Now he meets a wonderful one, he doesn't have any children. He meets a wonderful 55-year-old woman. So, falls in love with her, wants to marry her. Perfect. Am I supposed to tell him, I'm sorry, mister, you gotta look for a woman that's capable of having children, and a 55-year-old woman cannot have children? Although, did you read about this?
Yeah.
Some woman in Israel gave birth. How old was she? 60?
She's 60.
Yeah, she had to go to Russia. She had to go to Russia. Though. The Israel, for even in Israel, they would not do fertility treatments on a woman over 45. She went to Russia. They you know, for money they'll do it on an 80-year-old, and through an in vitro process, she was able to have children. Okay, but putting that aside, that's a theoretical question. But I would say that my answer to your question is this. We got to be real. If there's a realistic prospect that some 25-year-old will fall in love with him, okay. But if normal probabilities are, if not this, he'll have nothing, then it just makes no sense, right?
So job
may
somehow attractive he is.
No, because well, maybe how rich he is might be more relevant, but I don't know how to judge. It's a hard question. All I'm saying is, it would be the height of insensitivity and even stupidity for a rabbi to tell an older man, "You can't marry an older woman because you got to find somebody younger." Now. Sometimes it's happened. Sometimes it's happened that someone marries a younger woman and has children. But it's kind of a miracle. And halacha says you don't assume that these miracles will happen. So these are really hard questions. And a rabbi has to grapple with them. If a 35-year-old wants to marry a childless woman who can't have children, then I could safely tell him no. At some point, we're not going to do that, just because it just doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And if the woman knew she couldn't have children and she didn't tell him, it would be fraud, right?
That would be fraud, absolutely, absolutely.
I have another question.
Okay, one question.
What woman already has children?
Okay. So unfortunately, the woman having children doesn't count, because the commandment is on the man, see? So whether the woman had or didn't have has no impact on the man, because the man has to have kids.
But what he does with the other stuff he said, like pays for education.
Okay, so here I have to explain that there is a difference between what you call spiritual fulfillment of the mitzvah and halachic fulfillment of the mitzvah. Halachic fulfillment is not done by those other things. Spiritually, it's true, but halachically, he still has to do it a certain way. Okay, did you have one more?
My other question is, So I understand that a man has a mitzvah per vu, and therefore he has to marry somebody who can have children,
yes,
right? Now, say they find out afterwards that she can't accept, possibly with intervention, how much of an obligation is there to exhaust all financial, emotional, and physical resources that they have to try their best? Or are they allowed to say, naturally we can't? Okay.
Excellent question. And again, I guess my next class I'll devote totally to this, but let me just give you a brief answer, because we're running out of time. As you know, if you follow this, there have been tremendous, tremendous technological advances in reproduction. This is called ART. ART means assisted reproductive technologies. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Starting with artificial insemination, which is already more than 100 years old. That's not really new anymore. In vitro fertilization, ICSI, egg donation, all sorts of amazing ways of having children. But some of them involve surgical procedures, egg donation, in vitro fertilization, all of these procedures. The question is, how much pain, suffering, money, expense, inconvenience, all of these things, must a person endure to fulfill the mitzvah pru urvu? Does a woman, in fact, the woman doesn't even have the mitzvah, but in order to facilitate the man's mitzvah, does a woman have to undergo repeated operations, etc., and how much money has to be spent? Now, money, by the way, in Israel is less of a problem, because in the United States, especially with Obamacare, fertility treatments are not really given a high priority. So typically, an insurance company will only cover 2 in vitro fertilization attempts. If it doesn't work after 2, you're on your own. Israel will cover, under the Kupat Cholim, under our socialized medicine, we will cover an unlimited number. So Israel is a very good place. Besides, it is technologically very advanced, and the government covers it, because having children is an important thing in Israel. So they do encourage it. So, like many things in halacha, this is a major, major machloket. The great posek, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, you may have heard of, great, great, great man who died around 25 years ago, he took the position that the obligation of procreation is to procreate in the normal way. You try it by conventional marital intercourse, and if it doesn't work, there is no obligation to go beyond that. Other poskim say you have to do whatever you can. Now, I will tell you that it is at least customary among the Jewish population that they do try everything. Now, whether halachically they must, probably they don't have to. That's what Rav Orbach said. But I think emotionally the need to have children is very strong among all people, but among religious Jews it is especially strong. Part of it is connected to you know, the mitzvah of having children. Part of it is connected to the Holocaust, in which, you know, we need to make up our losses. Whatever the reason, I think the desire for children is extremely strong among religious people, and they will go to the ends of the earth to try to have a child. But if you're asking me under the naked halachic rule, it probably is not required. That was Rav Orbach's psak. Okay, okay, yeah.
So for a Hasidic woman who knows, like, before she starts looking to get married that she can't get pregnant, like, what options does that leave?
Okay, well, again, it's these are difficult situations, but the option is she should marry a widower who has children. And again, there are widowers around who might be interested. So again, it's not easy. But once again, halachically, a man who's capable of course, or she can marry a man who can't have children. That actually would work out as well. But a man who is capable of having children is halachically not allowed to marry a woman that he knows is not capable of having children. Now, what does it mean the woman is not capable? That's also an interesting question. Even if a woman has certain difficulties, but if those difficulties can be overcome by intervention, she may not have to tell her husband that, because she potentially could have children if certain steps are taken. You see, things are very murky. So I'll give you an example. Sometimes people have medical conditions that do not make pregnancy impossible, but it increases the odds against becoming pregnant. So then you get into very difficult questions. If my chances of getting pregnant are only 5 out of 10, do I have to say anything? What if it's 4 out of 10? What if it's 3 out of 10, right? They're going to be very, very difficult issues. I mean, the only thing I can tell you with certainty is, if for sure she can't have a kid, she has to say it and not marry the guy. Once we're dealing with percentages, that's a very different type of question. Yeah.
Are women required to, like, know what the odds of them...
No, they don't have to know. They can assume. A woman can normally assume that she'll be able to have children. I'm not saying you have to get yourself checked out. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if a woman knows she was sick and she was treated and she was given this information, at that point she can't close her eyes. But I'm not suggesting a woman has to.
No,
a woman does not have to undergo a fertility test in any way. You know, a woman can assume that she'll be able to have children. But, okay? So these are difficult questions. In fact, the whole issue, this is really another issue. See, all the Torah is all connected. One subject connects to the other. The issue is disclosure in shiduchim. I mean, all sorts of problems. Somebody had a nervous breakdown. Somebody's on psychiatric medicine. Someone has a fertility problem. Someone has a brother that's in prison. You know, the question is, or on the man's side, same thing on the man's side. I'm not saying it's only on the woman's side. No, when do you have to share that information? When do you tell that information, right? Big, big questions. Or if you don't tell, when do I tell? There's a law against Lashon Hara. I'm not supposed to say bad things about people. And yet, if I see somebody about to do something that's very detrimental to them, I'm supposed to step in. So do I pick up the phone and say, by the way, the person you're going to marry next Monday is an axe murderer. You may want to know. You know, so that's a whole big topic. Sometimes, Lashon Hara, which normally says keep your mouth shut, sometimes there's a mitzvah and an obligation to open your mouth and talk. You can't just say, I'm not going to tell you, I don't want to say anything bad about somebody. Sometimes you have to. So one of the most difficult questions is, when do you keep the negative information to yourself? When do you have to reveal it? The short answer is that if it's something that's only in the past and there's no issue of reoccurrence, then you don't need to reveal negative things of the past. If, on the other hand, there are things that will still come up in the marriage, whether it's a medical condition like infertility or whether it's a mental breakdown, that's something that you need to disclose, right? But things that have been taken care of and they're not going to happen again, you don't have to mention. On the other hand, sometimes we don't really know. Let's say, I'll give you, again, I apologize for skipping so many subjects, but as we talk, they come out. Let's say I have a friend, and I know, or an acquaintance, somebody, I know that 25 years ago, he punched his wife in the face. But since then, let's say now they're divorced or whatever it is, but since then, you know, he's had relationships, he's not been violent, he's undergone treatments. He's never done it again. He had one incident that was very, very bad. He's now engaged, or he's going out with somebody. Do I have to tell the shadchan or the girl about his one-time event? So here is the issue. The issue is he a person who is, there's a likelihood that he's going to hit his wife. If there's a likelihood of reoccurrence, she is entitled to be warned. If it's a past event that will not reoccur, it would be Lashon Hara. Well, that's the standard. So the question is it likely to occur or not? Do you say, once an abuser, always an abuser? Is that the attitude? Some psychologists will tell you yes. Any guy that ever abused can have a trigger to abuse again. Others say, well, doesn't Judaism believe in tshuva? Don't we believe in change? And if there's a track record, how many years? Isn't there a statute of limitations? 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? Isn't there a point at which we can say that he's demonstrated that he's a safe person? What about child abuse? Even worse. Pedophilia. Is there any point at which we would consider a person safe? Difficult questions. What this highlights is that even the greatest rabbi and posek needs to also consult with mental health professionals. This is important to understand. Halacha cannot be applied in a vacuum, in an abstract vacuum. Halacha depends on facts. Halacha depends on assessment of probabilities. And sometimes to know those facts and assess those probabilities, you need experts outside of the halacha, whether it's psychologists, whether it's social workers, whether it's lawyers, who can fill in the factual background so the halacha can be properly applied. Otherwise, the psak halacha is going to be garbage in, garbage out. Meaning if the data upon which the halachic judgment is made is a flawed data, the halachic decision is going to be tainted. So for a rabbi to say, I can make all decisions myself, that's a very, very big mistake. It's a mistake, first of all, halachically, because you need to talk to other rabbis. That's true. But it's also a mistake because you need to consult with others. That's why if you look at great poskim, like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that I mentioned, he always had engineers and doctors and social workers and psychologists that he would consult with regularly to be able to know how to apply these rules to these situations. Okay? Alrighty, so you all take care and have a good good week.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Why did you give an example, let's say, of your brother in jail? Why would you talk about that and
you're
talking about the person themselves?
No, no. Well, I gave it as an example. I didn't say what you do with it. Because.
No, I'm saying, why would that be a question of like having to tell or not?
Well, I think it would be a question because the family that people marry into is often important to them. And if the family has shameful or embarrassment in the family, that's something a woman would want to know because...
Okay, so it's the shameful embarrassment, not the effect.
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct.
Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah. Okay.